welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna, and our guest is semiconductor professional, Mahesh Tirupattur. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
And good morning, Mahesh.
Good morning, Mike and Dan.
Mahesh, Mike, and I are longtime friends, so this should be an interesting discussion. But first, Mahesh, let's go into how you got into semiconductors. What brought you to this industry?
Yeah, thanks, Dan and Mike, for having me here. Growing up in India, my parents were very much into the engineering field. My dad was one of the early pioneers to have brought electric motors in southern India, and having that submerged inside water, inventing the submersible pump. Eventually got distributed by many German companies, including Bosch and many other people. So we always had electrical factories, electronic components in our in my backyard. So as a kid, playing with breadboard, playing with transistors, building stuff, soldering, were all very much innate in me. And I think one of the worst curiosity for me was to break things and rebuild it again. I think there was I was pretty notorious for that, was to open up any new gadget which showed up at home in the middle of the night and getting an electric shock and then figuring out what gave me that shock. So the natural penchant and curiosity towards electronics was always there, and still have a little bit of it. And when I came to US to do my master's in electrical engineering, I started off in high voltage power engineering area and found a job in semiconductors in the early 90s. My first job was at Sun Microsystems, and clearly semiconductor was at the rise, and having an electronics curiosity and love for playing with transistors and playing with the components brought me more closer to semiconductors, and designing a microprocessor was one of the fun things to do in my early part of my career.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme amongst us semiconductor professionals, curiosity and taking things apart. I didn't necessarily get them back together again, but I definitely took a lot of things apart.
Trust me, there was only one out of 10 I was able to put it back.
So Mahesh, fast forward, tell us what brought you to analog bits, and more importantly, what has kept you there for 18 years?
Loyalty is probably the name of the game, but when I started at Sun, I met the founder of Analog Bits, Alan Rogers, and he and I worked together. He taught me a lot in terms of microprocessor circuit design, and we both were circuit designers designing high-speed cache memories, IOs, and PLLs. In 1990s, PLLs was one of the most exotic block one can design as a circuit designer. You almost wear one of the beards and the unshowered characters who are put aside in a corner room. But designing analog in 1990 was fun. And over the years, I had left Sun Microsystems along with the founder, who left around the same time. And I embarked on doing sales and marketing and going after the dark side or the green side or whatever you can call it. My early part of my career, I also co-founded a company called Virtual Silicon, which was designing IPs. And Analog Bits is one of the suppliers for these IPs. And Analog Bits was started by Alan Rogers in 1996. And then he did a lot of consulting work for us. And while Virtual Silicon was trying to go up on the ground, I personally struggled to deal with the VCs and their mentality of an IP company and not being customer focused. So in 2003, I left Virtual Silicon to join Analog Bits with Alan Rogers, and both of us built this company. What's kept me this long? It's a very good question. I really enjoy this job. In fact, if you looked at my career, everywhere I stayed only for a maximum 3-4 years, but whereas at Analog Bits, I never left. And I really found the home. And I really enjoyed building the company because there is a highest degree of trust between Alan and myself and the highest degree of integrity in terms of how we built this company and how we treat our people. It became a big one happy family, something that I really cherish and endear close to my heart. And the journey is not over. It's beginnings of bigger things to come. And I never felt that it's been 18 years in this journey, and it's been I still feel the first day I started there. And I think the passion for us to do great things and the freedom to do great things at the same time, making a difference to the world and having fun and running a decently profitable business is kept me going. And I still get inspired every morning I wake up, and I want to do some bigger and better things for the company.
You know, Mahesh, your comment about virtual silicon brings up a little bit of the fact how small this industry can be. Quick story for me, when eSilicon was formed back in 2000, we found that virtual silicon had the trademark on a product line called eSilicon. So I called up Taylor Scanlon over there and I explained the situation. He thought about it for a minute and said, you know, you guys can do a lot more with that name than we can. I'll give it to you. Just, I want to sign something that says if you ever go out of business, you'll give it back to me. So I agreed to that. I went over to his office with a nice eSilicon sweatshirt. I gave him the sweatshirt. He gave me the trademark, and away we went. So my paths crossed with Taylor, as yours did a long time ago. It was interesting.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about analog design, because it is a unique talent, it's a unique market, and smaller, you know, companies like Analog Bits seem to thrive, whereas bigger companies maybe not. So in regards to the designing these products, Mahesh, what keeps you awake at night? You know, what are the challenges you have experienced, and moving forward, you know, what do we have in store for us?
Yeah. You know, analog design is all about precision and perfection, it's an analog design is never perfect. There's always some flaws in it which can be improved. But the trick is, how do you get it to be good enough and reliable enough for the first go in the market? You don't have many tools to verify what you've done, and you don't have a lot of supervision, because there are far and few great analog design engineers. So it's it's a mentality of engineering. You almost have to be super critical about yourself and almost be a bit of a cynic. So having that characteristics of an engineer, with the combination of curiosity to just simply improve your perfection and precision is a very important attribute for an analog engineer. And not to put on my friends in the digital world, there are tools to verify everything in digital, assertions, you know, name it, and the scripts, and there's EDA companies just writing all kinds of software. In analog, there is really, it's a few strokes, like Picasso's, you know, a painting. You just got to get those few strokes perfectly right. And picking those strokes and doing that is the most important thing. Being thoughtful about what your goals are and what you're achieving in a time-efficient manner, and getting it all together is what makes analog design a unique thing. Yes, analog is a boutique talent, but it's clearly becoming a broader segment of the industry where there's more market adoption for it. And companies like us, thanks to fabs like TSMC and Samsung and GlobalFoundry, who give us the opportunity to create a level playing field with all the big companies, that we are able to project and portray what we are capable of in the market. So I think the future is extremely bright. There's enormous scarcity value for the things we do there, and we become vital for the market and for every SoC design. And I just see this as a positive factor. All we need is more precision and perfection-oriented engineers to come, who are a little bit more critical and cynical about life, and come and do great analog design.
Mahesh, you know, you talked about the artistic nature of analog IP design. I agree with you on that. There's one thing I want to poke at, though.
you know, it's been said that analog IP is never reused. There's always tweaks for every single title. Has that been your experience, and how do you deal with that constant customization? I guess said the most blunt way, how do you make money when every single piece of IP needs hand modification?
Excellent question, Mike. You know, when I was at Virtual Silicon, the first product that we introduced was eSilicon ESI PLL compiler. Interesting that we ended up renaming that product later on after eSilicon and us graciously came to an agreement. But the concept was we wanted to build a PLL compiler where an analog composition was hidden behind a compilation technology where users can generate any clock frequency with any input frequency. And we knew that at that time that analog was a high custom, high touch market. And building a compiler was a start of seeing how this can play into the world. And soon, when it came to analog bits, I realized that you don't really need to build a compiler. You can actually build a general purpose clocking macro. And then we came up with the concept of this wide range PLL, which then evolved into integer, fracken, and everything. So is there customization? Yes, but you can be smart about building a product which you can have it 60 to 80%. And I say 80%, I'll give you an extreme example in another product line. But in the clocking area, about 50 to 60% of your building block is pretty standard. And then you customize around it. And the trick is, you don't customize everything. You build a baseline IP which does 60 to 80% of the functionality, and the remaining things you personalize it based on customer and application needs. Now, does everyone need customization? No. Most of our customers will say, yeah, there's a small overhead, but it's a don't care for me and I'll use it as is. But someone who says, well, I want that last microamp of power to be squeezed out, I need this to be custom because I need the BCOs to be running at a certain frequency. I don't need all the divide flexibility. So yeah, so you take a base design and you strip it down or you augment it to customize it. And the trick is, once you have a base design, you know, you charge an NRE for customization, but there's also your base license included as a part of it. So yeah, you can make money as long as you have a solid start. And another extreme, when we came up with this concept of a PVT sensor a few years ago, that needed less amount of customization, a few tweaks in terms of scannability, but most of the stuff was selling it as is. And we see that kind of a trend when you're smart enough to spec the product which will have a broad reach from the get. Yes, expect customization, but keep the customization anywhere between 20 to 30% of the development. The remaining is just baseline design. And that concept is where analog bits has been focused a lot more the last 3 to 5 years, mainly when we're developing our products, to make sure something is good to start with.
That's interesting. So it's really building flexibility in from the start, and you can accommodate the requests that way. You know, a related question, how do you test and release analog IP? How do you prove it works? You know, in the digital world, there's test benches and there's very well-defined stimulus packages. How does it work in the analog world?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. Analog problems don't occur typically at the boundaries, very rarely. Yeah, somebody really messes up. But those things can be functionally tested on simulation. The biggest failure in analog is the assumptions people have made and not having learned from the previous past. There is an interesting phrase within analog bits team, and not to put any fabs down, always assume the fab models are off and you will never be disappointed. So you've got to almost build a certain degree of conservatism and a guard band in the design. You have to assume everything has to work by physics and not just by simulation. These things have to work by physics. And that's very important philosophy of an analog. Having said that, in the early life of analog bits up to 40 nanometer, test chip was a nice to have. But starting 40, test chips became more and more important. And starting FinFETs, it's a mandatory thing. Everything we design, almost everything we design, 90 to 95% of the design blocks that we do are proofed by test chip, either by us most of the time or by our customer before they go into mainstream production. Now, there are small modifications, like if someone says, hey, I need an extra divider, I need an extra MUX. Those things are not test chip proven, but the base design, time and time again, is proven. Now, as a company, we try to maintain the same architecture across generation. And what that does is, at least there is a proof point from the past historical data that this has worked in, let's say, a 12 nanometer or 16 nanometer FinFET. Now it's being ported to 7 and eventually to 5 and eventually to 3. So the base design is fundamentally there. So the knowledge of how the architecture works is very well understood. And what we have done is finessed individual components to improve the characteristics of the IP. So having that type of discipline and mentality where you leverage existing design, of course you'd add novelty as you go to newer challenges, and maintaining that is very, very critical for our customers and also helps us develop products along our roadmap much quickly.
Mahesh, you mentioned the founders. I mean, this is kind of interesting because I work with the founders. In fact, you and I run into each other more often in Asia than we do in the United States. How do you manage the foundry relationships? I know you do it personally. You work with all the foundries. I have heard nothing but good things about your products and your company through the foundries. You guys are really good at getting first silicon. I mean, how did you manage that?
I started working with the foundries, Dan, in 1994 when I was just entering the IP business. And interesting, my first title was Marketing Manager for Foundry Relationship. I think I kept that title still close to my heart and never gave that away to anyone else. Maybe I'm a little possessive about it. But yeah, I mean, in 94, when the fabs were, when TSMC was on the rise trying to catch up to mainstream, I was personally involved with it, and so was other fabs like UMC. And over the years, especially in the early 2000, Samsung and TSMC and Global Foundries and Chartered at that time were all up on the rise. It is very important for us to work with the foundries. One of the things I realized in early part of my marketing career is, end of the day, the fab cannot have an excuse why the customer silicon didn't work. And if IP was a reason, you get blacklisted very quickly. So it is the holy grail of making sure your IP works. And therefore, having that deep connection with the foundries in terms of being their strategic partner and being transparent and working with them in a collaborative manner and creating the symbiotic partnership has always been in AnalogBits DNA. Pretty much the way that the company should operate. So that's been always the case, and getting access to early process nodes vis-a-vis early customer engagement or fabs trusting us to give us access to this so we can proof the IP has always been very critical. And that's been the success of AnalogBits, is being an early adopter of advanced process nodes and creating novel IPs on each of them. And going to market together with the foundries.
You know, Mahesh, analog IP is considered by some to be a leading indicator of market focus. You know, what's the latest interface for sensor and so forth? Do you see that happening at AnalogBits? Said another way, what are the most popular IP titles you're selling today, and have you seen that trend change over time? And is that sort of a tip off to what's happening in the rest of the industry?
It's a very interesting question, Mike. I agree with you that the leading indicator is analog design. Now, think of a customer who's designing a 3-nanometer design in a fab, which is going into production maybe 2022. Well, today, analog IP has to be taped out because the most in semiconductor, it's become not a sum game, it's a product game. Everything has to work together. And the first failures are noticed in analog. Digital eventually catches up because there's enough tools to cover as many things. But the first failures are noticed in analog. So given that, analog IP has to be ported and has to be proofed and has to be silicon qualified at least 6 months to 9 months before the customer does a production tape out. And over the life of that, there's process rule changes and PDK changes. So unless the base design is solid, people don't have the ability to even have analog IP on SoC designs. So it's imperative to proof these IPs. Having said that, we see sensors, today's newer problems in sensors is just not only temperature and voltage, but power supply monitoring. AI chips today have huge power spikes and ability to detect these power spikes in real time and give software the right guidance is very, very important. It's becoming a huge issue. Clocking is becoming a big issue again. Clock power distribution is becoming the biggest headache. So we are very excited about our pinless technology that we're bringing in 5 nanometer and eventually in 3 nanometer. We believe that will change the way clocking and sensing is done. IOs are some of the most interesting composition, how they interact with the outside world. And IOs being either a parallel IO or a SerDes grade IO is becoming more important. Chiplets are driving the new generation of process. So C2C IOs, SerDes, clocks and sensors are all leading indicators today of process nodes and what's happening in each of them. So we clearly see that today we are literally taping out our 3 nanometer this quarter. So it's a rapid race for the finish. And we somewhat feel like we are be the Marines. We got to go land first and figure out what's out there, and then call the rest of the crew. So it's very much in the industry where analog is indeed becoming a leading indicator of future SoCs.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've always believed that analog design is the foundation for everything else, and you're kind of voicing that opinion as well. I want to switch gears here a bit. Analog Bits is famous for its wine gift each holiday season for its customers and partners. I happen to know a little bit of the background of that, and the way that bottle of wine is created is an interesting story of teamwork. Would you share that for our listeners? I think that's an interesting story.
Aha, Mike, you got me on a personal note here. I love that story. When Analog Bits was started, it was just Alan and me. And one of the ways we used to say thank you to a customer during Christmas was to give a bottle of wine and then have a little label stuck on it saying that thank you for business from Analog Bits. But I think over the years, we wanted to make this wine a more democratic process where we wanted to make sure our engineers were involved. As I was growing up in the engineering community, I always saw the sales and marketing guys drink fancy wine and go to fancy restaurants. Well, I want to solve that problem, making sure all engineers had a voice in what having great dinners and having a wonderful wine. So at Analog Bits, you will see our engineers are very famous with labels like Opus 1 and Camus because it is indeed served in our Christmas parties. But the concept was wine was always, I always felt wine is analog, which I still believe it is. And having said that, one of the things is, What is a refined taste in wine? It's a very subjective opinion. So wanted to make sure that we do a polling process within the team. So every year I bring about 5 or 6 bottles of wine, blind it, and have our engineers rank it. We go through a standard tasting profile of taste, sight, and palate and everything, and then people sort of learn that. And once you teach them, well, what do you rate of this wine? What do you rate of this wine? Yeah, we're not psalms, but clearly there's a psalm-like activity going on within Analog Bits just to see how people react to flavors and taste. And that kind of helps us build a better wine. Just like analog design, it's a collaborative process. Even the choice of wine, we try and keep the same story. And over the years, we've managed to find some really good winemakers in Napa who would private label these wines for us with our logo and the varietal on it. So it became sort of a trend, and I'm pretty excited about it. I still want to continue that.
Thank you for that backstory. It's fun to hear that. And for those out there listening, if you've gotten a bottle or two of wine from Mahesh and you have it sitting on the shelf somewhere, I'm here to tell you, those are good bottles of wine. Open them up and drink them. You won't be sorry.
Yeah, we just finished our last one, actually. We just now.
So, oh, time for refill. Anyway.
I think that's a hint, Mahesh.
I got the message.
Keep sending wine. All right, we're running out of time, so let's go ahead and finish up here. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Mahesh. Great content, and we will have you back soon for sure.
Thank you, Dan and Mike, for the opportunity.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day. Thank you.